Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
British public spending is being cut and the defence budget is not immune. What will this mean for our future military deployments?
Overall, we retain, as I say, a broad spectrum capability. There is nothing overwhelmingly embarrassing in terms of what we've given up.
The Palestinian leadership is preparing to call for a United Nations resolution declaring Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem illegal. What are the chances of this passing?
It would merely be a way of embarrassing Israel, of driving a wedge between Israel and the international community.
We look ahead to the G20 finance ministers meeting in South Korea. Will there be any agreement on currency manipulation or bank capital levels?
It's not clear whether we've yet come to a point where there's going to be a more united front than we've seen before against China in G20.
And we get the latest on the ongoing Vatican money laundering case.
It'll be the first case where the Vatican has decided to seek redress through the Italian courts.
You're listening to World Weekly with me, David Blair. I'm joined in the studio by James Blitz, our diplomatic editor, and on the line with Tobias Buck in Jerusalem, Christian Oliver in Seoul, and Guy Dinmore in Rome. Turning first of all to the defence review that's just been announced here in Britain, the UK armed forces are facing the biggest defence cuts since the Cold War. So where does this leave our future military options? James, to what extent was this a cost-cutting exercise and to what extent was it about strategy?
Well, there's no question that it was driven by budgetary problems and cost-cutting. We have in the UK a huge budget deficit of about 11% of GDP. And the Ministry of Defence also has a huge budgetary overhang, a black hole, because it bought loads and loads of equipment over the last decade without actually having the money to cover it. So a very considerable consolidation had to happen. The main question is, having pushed through all those cuts, did we have a kind of coherent picture of what British defence is about at the end? And I think to some degree we did. I think what drove these decisions by David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, was the need basically to not drop any major capabilities that it looks like were unprepared for the future. I think what's driven all the thinking in this review is that we just don't know what the major threats are going to be over the next 5 years. Is it going to be cyber? Is it going to be state-on-state warfare, perhaps prompted by an Iran crisis? Is terrorism going to sort of resurge? And so what's happened is we haven't cut any major capability that stops us doing any of this stuff. But in order to make that decision, we've also had to come up with some very messy compromises.
Can you list some of those messy compromises? What's the messiest of them all?
Well, the messiest unquestionably is that we have ended up building two aircraft carriers over the next few years, but we are going to have to mothball one of them, and we're then almost going to have to sell it, even though it's going to cost us £2.5 billion to build it. The issue there was that it would have actually, because we've started building these carriers, it would have actually cost us more to cancel one of them than to build it. So that's one of the compromises. Mm. But people also say, well, at least it leaves us with some potential for heavy state-on-state warfare capability in the 2020s. A second huge problem is that we completely scrapped the Nimrod MR4 reconnaissance plane, which was a project on which we'd already spent in the UK £3 billion, not a single, and these planes were just about to come into service, but we've dropped it to save running costs, but that doesn't give us a lot of the capability we need to actually protect our independent nuclear deterrent. Mm. So these are the kind of compromises we've made. But in order to preserve this broader picture of a full spectrum capability.
Mm-hmm. And on the question of the nuclear deterrent, is it settled now that Trident will be replaced?
Yes, it will. We are going to retain an independent deterrent. But what has happened is that the government has sought to squeeze money and costs out of the program to replace the four submarines that carry the Trident D5 missiles. So the first of these new submarines is not actually going to come into service until 2028 rather than around 2024. Now, the issue there is that the submarines we currently have, the Vanguard submarines, are coming to the end of their natural lives, and a lot of people in the Navy think that you just can't continue to keep these in service. So the risk by extending the life of these submarines is that they might break down and you might have a lack of capability. But the assurance has been given that this won't happen, although I do think there will be debate on that in the future.
Mm. And what's the general feeling among the armed forces top brass? Do they think they've escaped less badly scathed than they feared they would be? Or do they think that this is a review which has cut too deeply?
I think the view is that they have broadly escaped. It has been very, very painful, especially, for example, for the Air Force, which has seen a significant reduction in the number of fast jets that we will have, and also for the Navy, which will see a reduction of the surface fleet. The Army has probably come off best because it's in Afghanistan. David Cameron just didn't want to cut Army numbers. Overall, we retain, as I say, a broad spectrum capability. There is nothing overwhelmingly embarrassing in terms of what we've given up. Nobody can turn round to the UK and say, right, you no longer do state-on-state warfare. You no longer do stabilisation of the kind that you do in Afghanistan. You are no longer committed to fighting terrorism, and you are prepared for this thing of cyber warfare. But overall, we are very thinly stretched across these capabilities, and it will be tested over time as to whether we are really properly prepared for any kind of surprise problem that emerges in the next few years.
Has this clearly moved us down the military league tables? Are we still in the France League?
In one sense, we haven't. Two key things have happened. One, we are still above 2% of GDP in terms of defence spending, and that keeps us in the top four in the world, China, the United States, and France among them, in terms of defence spending. That's the good news. But we have a lower capability. We will not be able to send 45,000 troops into a hot warfare situation in the way we did in Iraq in 2003. We'll have a significantly reduced capability. So we can do less of what we did, but we haven't had a complete adjustment which really puts us down among the Europeans in general terms, which is what the government wanted to avoid.
James, thank you very much. Turning now to the issue of the Middle East peace process, Palestinian leaders are looking perhaps to the United Nations for a resolution on the future of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Where does the peace process stand now? Tobias, are you there in Jerusalem?
Yes, I am.
Assuming that the impasse over the settlement issue is not broken, what options do the Palestinians now have?
Well, the Palestinian leadership is clearly thinking about, in one way or the other, internationalizing the Middle East conflict. Of course, it always has been a big issue at the UN, a big issue for European countries and for the US in particular. But what the Palestinians are thinking about now is to get some kind of UN resolution that would give them political backing. Now, the original idea, which has been around for quite a while, is that the Palestinians would ask the UN Security Council to essentially recognize a Palestinian state in the borders of 1967. That is still an option that is on the table, though one that probably will only really surface next year or at a moment when Israel is even more isolated than it is now. For now, what the Palestinians are thinking about is trying to introduce a resolution at the Security Council that would formally declare Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and in occupied East Jerusalem illegal.
What chance would such a resolution have of actually passing?
That's very difficult to say now. Of course, the US has a very long tradition of vetoing any UN Security Council resolution that is critical of Israel or that makes life difficult for Israel. What the Palestinians are saying, though, is that it is long-standing U.S. policy that they are opposed to Jewish settlements, and though there might be some ambivalence on the issue of whether they're illegal or not, it would certainly be quite difficult for the U.S., or so the Palestinians believe, to veto a resolution that targets specifically the settlements, just because we have had so many statements from the U.S. President, from the Secretary of State, that have clearly identified settlements as one of the prime obstacles to peace in the Middle East.
So the Palestinians have the option of using the UN Security Council to turn up the heat on Israel. Aside from that, what other options do they have if we assume that the direct peace talks are not going to resume?
Well, the Palestinians have been basically talking about the same ideas for many years now. There is the sort of Big Bang solution, which would mean dissolving the Palestinian Authority, the quasi-government that was established as part of the Oslo treaties, and basically saying to Israel, well, you know, we have this quasi-government, but you never gave us a proper state. So now we're going to switch our fight away from trying to establish an independent Palestinian state, and instead we'll try and become part of Israel, but with the right to vote for every Palestinian living in the West Bank and in Gaza and East Jerusalem. And that, of course, would create a major headache. It would essentially mean the end of the Jewish state, given the demographic realities in that region. But I think that is not a step that the Palestinians are anywhere close to taking. I think that is still above all a tactic, a tool to increase the pressure on Israel and on the international community. And that really is where, according to the Palestinians at least, the beauty of this settlement resolution lies, in that it does not force the Palestinians into a wholesale political change. It means that the success that the Palestinian Authority has had over the last few years in building the institutions, or in building functioning institutions of a state, would not be compromised. It would merely be a way of embarrassing Israel, of driving a wedge between Israel and the international community, and so increasing the pressure on Israel to compromise once the negotiations take off again.
And where does Palestinian public opinion stand on all this? If the Palestinian Authority leadership is under public pressure, in which direction is that pressure pushing them?
Well, that's very interesting, because indeed the Palestinians have very, very little faith in these talks. According to a poll published this week, only 6% of Palestinians believe that the peace talks launched in Washington last month will actually yield a result. They were asked also in this poll about what alternatives they prefer, and indeed their preferred option is going to the UN, trying to get a UN Security Council resolution recognizing an independent Palestinian state. And there's also a lot of support for the idea of an unarmed, a non-violent intifada or uprising, basically that would presumably take the form of demonstrations and peaceful protests. But there is also quite a lot of support for the resumption of violence against Israel, and this, of course, has to be something that worries Palestinian leaders, Israeli leaders, yes, and of course the international community as well.
Yes, well, there's much food for thought there. Tobias, thank you very much. Moving on to the G20 Finance Ministers Summit that will commence in South Korea. The issue which they're going to be dealing with is the future of global currencies, and in particular the danger of competitive devaluations amid the global economic slowdown. Turning now to Christian Oliver in Seoul. How great is the danger of a global currency war with competitive devaluations and countries inadvertently damaging everyone's interests by doing this?
Seemingly quite high. Well, the Brazilians, I think, were the first to actually come out and say that there was a danger of a currency war. People are now trying to play it down, and I think what we're going to see at the meeting in Gyeongju is a sort of mixture of some groups who don't really want to discuss it, and then others are going to fudge it to a point of view where they pussyfoot around the issue to an extent that probably doesn't help avert a war very successfully. We've got, just before this meeting, the Chinese came out very simply and said it would be a wrong direction for the U.S. and other nations aggravated by a weaker renminbi to use the G20 in Gyeongju as a forum for ganging up against China, saying they would upset world
markets that showed such a disunited front. So there's a sense from the Chinese that they don't think the G20 is an area where these discussions should happen. Then we've got the South Koreans who start the draft rolling, really trying to spread the blame and the range of factors behind currency distortions very much more broadly than simple currency manipulation to help exporters. They themselves, of course, are coming into focus as a country that wants to slap on more capital controls. So they're very keen to find wordings and formulas that accept that within the G20 forum, within the G20 process as well. Really, you know, sort of arguing that in a world of ultra low interest rates, with heavy currency speculation, carry trades, it's very hard for them to look after their own currency. So I think they want to try and get some side of a sign that nations are perhaps warming to the idea of some limited temporary capital control should be allowed. So I think there are quite a lot of competing factions within the G20 at the moment, and I'm not sure any of them are going to successfully avert this currency war.
And I was going to ask, how great is the pressure on China now to revalue the renminbi? Do you think the Americans might at least muster a substantial coalition in their favour in the G20 on that issue?
That does look like it's growing, T. One of the more interesting things is there hasn't really been a concerted front against China at the G20. I mean, it's often been left in the public sphere to be a rather duelist battle between the United States and China. What may be happening now is that other nations, particularly big trading nations with frustrations against China, might come into play. It's not clear whether we've yet come to a point where there's going to be a more united front than we've seen before against China in G20.
Well, Christian, thank you very much for that. Coming back now to Europe, an Italian court has rejected a bid from the Vatican to unfreeze €23 million of its funds in what is believed to be the first case of the Vatican, which is of course a sovereign state, seeking redress through the Italian judicial system. What on earth is going on? Guy Dimore, can you enlighten us?
Well, it is a very confusing affair indeed, but there seem to be two processes at work. One is the Bank of Italy. In recent years, the central bank is tightening up its regulations to combat money laundering in line with the rest of the international community. And on the other hand, it does seem that the Vatican Bank itself, which answers really only to itself and to a group of cardinals and the Pope, is also trying to put its accounts in order after a whole series of scandals going back to the 1980s and the famous case of Banco Ambrosiano. And the Vatican Bank itself has not actually been accused of money laundering, but they're being accused of breaking anti-money laundering regulations. And the reports that are coming out in Italian media today suggest that, in fact, the Italian investigators are spreading the scope of their investigation and have found other suspect transactions that they're worried about.
Just how secretive are the Vatican's finances? How much do we know about the way the Catholic Church manages its network of funds around the world?
Not a lot. The Vatican does publish accounts on the sort of budget of the operations of its government, but it doesn't really publish accounts on its entire incomes and expenditure around the world. And the Vatican Bank itself, which is known as the Institute for Religious Works, doesn't publish its accounts. So there are estimates, for example, that the Vatican Bank has assets of $5 billion, but beyond that there's not a lot known about it. I mean it does operate a sort of worldwide network of, you know, charities, missions, hospitals. After the UN, the Vatican runs the world's second biggest aid operations. So it is responsible for parceling out large sums of money. But also, it has personal accounts for all the Vatican employees, of whom there are thousands, priests around the world, and some private individuals who really have sort of tenuous connections with the Vatican. And I think the Italian investigators are beginning to look at priests they suspect of acting as fronts for shady businessmen, prominent people in the Italian world who have been using, possibly using, this is what is being alleged in the newspaper, the Vatican Bank to recycle money.
And what exactly is the legal position on this? It seems very odd that one, at least on paper, sovereign state is appealing to the courts in another sovereign state. How on earth legally is that possible?
I think that the reason this has happened this way is that the money that was seized in an Italian bank, Credito Artigiano. And the Vatican Bank had an account at this Italian bank and was making transfers through it. And those transfers were deemed to be suspicious, so that account was frozen. So it's an account frozen in an Italian bank by an Italian court. So really, the only way for the Vatican then to seek redress was through the Italian system. It's not the government of the Vatican as such that has gone to court. It is actually the Vatican Bank itself. So, I think a foreign bank can obviously go to an Italian court just like any other foreign bank can. I mean, there are plenty of foreign banks involved in Italian trials at the moment, in fact. So, but what is unusual about this case is that the Vatican, on the whole, has tended, I think, to try and avoid the Italian judicial system. And this is believed to be the first case where the Vatican, at least at the level, at a very high level, has decided to seek redress through the Italian courts.
Guy, thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to my guests, James Blitz, Tobias Buck, Christian Oliver and Guy Dinmore. World Weekly was produced by Emily Cadman. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.